It's the Barry Pod on 99.3 thevine.com.
This is the Barry Pod, recorded January 18th, 2024. And in the pod this time, Amber Manfrey. Welcome.
Thank you.
You are a candidate for supervisor in Napa County in District 4, and this is your second time around the track as a candidate. Why are you running?
Well, I'm running for supervisor in District 4 because I deeply believe that this community deserves really forward-looking leadership, especially right now. We have so many challenges, and there's a lot of uncertainty in the community. I mean, on a lot of issues, but I think it's a little extra right now because of the impacts of climate change and because the economy has been really touchy. So I'm hoping to bring the skills I have and put them to work for the people of this county.
Talk about your background for a little bit. You were born and raised in Napa?
I was raised in Napa. My family's been in Upper Soda Canyon since the 1930s, and my great-great-grandparents came here around 1900 and were farmers near Tula Cay. So I was raised in a multi-generational household with all kinds of cousins and aunts and uncles and a lot of stories about this place. And it was also very beautiful because I was in Upper Soda Canyon. It was very wild, and I really connected to the landscape, which led me to a career in natural resources. And that's the kind of work I've been doing and want to do here for the people.
As I mentioned, you ran in 2020 for this supervisor seat. Was there a particular issue or set of issues that got you into that race?
Well, in the early 2010s, I started to get more and more involved in conservation advocacy right here in Napa County. And at that point, I had long since completed my BA and been working in the field for about 10 years and was partway through doing my dissertation work at Davis. And I could really see that the skills I had in analyzing change and understanding policy had a lot of good applications here for helping think more deeply about our land use issues. And so I was involved with my neighbors in some advocacy for projects in the county. And through that process, ended up at a lot of meetings looking at the governance that we had and realizing that that we really do need more scientists in government. And I think at some point it dawned on me that I might be that scientist. And that was the beginning of this journey.
That's a really interesting thing to depart on for just a moment when you say we need more scientists in government. Anybody who's tried to wade their way through a packet for a meeting, a planning commission meeting particularly, at the county level, you're dealing with proposals for vineyards, not just vineyards, but homes and businesses and all kinds of things that involve grading and drainage and soil types and so many factors that the layman, person who's not studied any of this stuff, you're kind of trusting the experts. You're trusting the county staff. You're trusting somebody testifying for either the applicant or against the applicant, right?
Yeah.
That's a lot to sort out. Do you think, if you look around at Napa today, people hold us up as a beautiful place, always, bucket list to visit and so on. Have we made a mess of it through that process of not having enough scientists?
Oh gosh, no, we're doing an amazing job conserving this landscape. But the thing about conservation is that there's always the counter pressure on it. And to manage sustainably long into the future, especially with the kinds of changes we're seeing, we have been gifted a very green landscape that has been preserved through the agricultural preserve and other related rules that have been adopted over the years, the hillside ordinance and other rules that that have left this landscape largely intact. But there are also pressures that are holding it back from achieving its full potential. So the Napa River used to be the best salmon stream in the whole San Francisco Bay Area of all of the tributaries. But right now, we hardly have any salmon at all or steelhead. And bringing it back to that point, we're really not that far off, but it will take a little science and a little hard work, and we can probably do it. And that's just one specific example, but the kind of thing that I hope to work on, because we have a lot to save here And it's time to start working on that as a community.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the land preservation you're talking about, what do you think is the biggest danger to the natural ecosystem, whether that's the watershed itself or the river or the streams?
Well, it's not going to be too shocking, but I really do believe it's climate change, because we're in a situation where the environment is becoming increasingly unpredictable. And our native species here in California, they are adapted to surviving very wide shifts in their environmental conditions, but they've never had to do that while there are passage barriers for fish where they can't swim upstream as far as they used to, or decreasing habitat for even for something as common as a deer to graze in. The type of land that we're converting the fastest is grasslands from a wild state to vineyards. And I'm not saying that we have to put a pause on everything, but we need to look at it strategically and just think about the mix that we're generating and whether it's going to allow animals to move across the landscape when there's a wildfire. I've definitely heard some stories that during the fires, there were some bad things that happened because there was just a lot of fencing. And I don't want to get into too much detail on that, but it's just thinking about these things as a system and strategically, and getting more people to the table to really roll up their sleeves and problem solve. I really believe in this community's capacity to do good stakeholder processes. I think the flood management project is a beautiful example of that. And I'd like to see us do more work on that scale.
So let me hit you with a couple of sort of yes or no, true or false kind of things. There are some people who I think would say that if Amber Manfrey gets elected, you would never vote for a new vineyard development project. True or false?
False.
If a vineyard development project did not get your support, what would be the problem with it if you follow that line of thinking?
Sure. So we, for all of our vineyard developments, there's a size basis, but over a certain acreage, they automatically trigger a full environmental impact report at this point. And that's a pretty high bar to meet. So that ensures some level of, we always have erosion control plans locally, and then the environmental impact reporting process assures that if there are threatened or endangered or special status species present, that they'll be considered and the impacts will be mitigated. So the things that we're not doing necessarily is we're not right now necessarily always following the process as it was designed to work. So I would want to make sure that was happening. And if we can meet that bar, then of course, those are entitlements that go with the land, that sort of thing. We also have a situation where the habitat corridors have been designated, but they don't have any special protections. And that's been an issue in some recent projects. And I think looking at the landscape more strategically can help. There's a process called a habitat conservation plan, which Yolo County has recently completed, and Sonoma County is working on one. There's dozens of these all over the state. But Napa's never done this process. And I'm a proponent of us taking that step forward, because it will allow us to really look at the big picture, make a plan that maintains the habitat values that we have, but also allows for some development. And the way it works is for areas that are designated as having a low habitat value, but still having potential for, productive agriculture or other development, you can get a blanket EIR that covers those, which is favorable for the developer. And then for the other areas which have been designated as having a very high habitat value or other value that is assessed through the process, those areas would be off limits. And it creates that certainty, which right now so many people are saying they want. And I really think the best way to get there is through a process like that. It's a big deal to do a process like that. It takes time, it takes money, and it takes engagement. But right now, we're not in a really functional situation. So it's a pathway to get us to a place where there's better, overall planning. And we can start to focus on other problems that we have in the community, which I would like for us to get to that.
Mm-hmm. Another quick hit question here. Amber Manfrey is anti-wine industry. True or false?
False. Oh, my gosh. You know, the wine industry and the tourism industry are the absolute engine of our economy. And, you know, like I was saying at the beginning here, my family's been in this place for a very long time. And I mean, I'm even old enough to remember when the wine industry was much sleepier and smaller. And it's been a joy to watch it blossom. I mean, it's incredible. It's exceeded everyone's expectations, I think. And it you know, to make sure that we can keep it in its sweet spot, that's a community process, you know. So I'm here to do that work.
Amber Manfrey in the Berry Pod, candidate for supervisor in District 4. Your opponent in the race is Pete Mott, who was a Napa City Council member and a business person, and has the endorsement of the Napa Chamber of Commerce. Reflect on that. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, we're candidates in a race. We're all trying to get all kinds of endorsements and show off our talents and our what we stand for. So I guess I can say I am a small business person myself. I've been operating a consulting firm doing environmental analysis for about 5 years now. And I was previously the board president for a small business in Sonoma County way back in the early 2000s. So I do have business experience. And, you know, beyond that, I really value our business community. I love to patronize small businesses and see people succeed. So, you know, I don't think there's necessarily some kind of conflict there. I've been endorsed by Scott Sedgley, the mayor of Napa, by Joelle Gallagher, supervisor, by the union that represents county employees. And that is county employees' opportunity to say, you know, the kind of leadership they're hoping to see going forward. So, I invite everyone who may be curious about endorsements to look at my webpage and see the full list. I've also been endorsed by Sierra Club and BayArea350.org, which is a climate organization. So, you know, I think there's a lot of people that are excited to see the kind of skills that I have brought into leadership.
I want to get into a little bit more specifics because, in my opinion, I've voiced this maybe on the air in the Berry Pod episodes, that there was a shift in the wind not too long ago with a couple of different projects, development projects. And I always come back to the feeling that no matter what else is going on in Napa, land use is number one. Land use is what people care about. Whether it's a development in their residential neighborhood they think affects their property values, or it's environmental and wildlife and all these other things, right? And there are people who feel like the wine industry has just grown enough and it's a good time to stop. So there's all these different land use related attitudes and opinions. Going forward into this next section, the two issues I'm thinking about that created this big shift were the decision by the owners of the Walt Ranch property not to continue pursuing that development. That was, to me, a shock, right? After many years of putting a lot of investment into that and seeming to be determined to do it. And then all of a sudden, that changed. And then the other one was the more recent La Colline decision, which I think if you look at those two things in, you know, a connection to each other or relationship to each other, both of those were unexpected outcomes, right? First of all, I guess I'd ask, do you agree that that represents some kind of fundamental shift in thinking, those two things that happened? Are we in a new era in terms of land use in Napa County?
I think that this county over the last 10 years has had more disasters, period, than any other county in the state. We have endured earthquakes, a big earthquake in 2014, major fires, floods, landslides, COVID, like everybody else. And I do think that weighs on people's minds. You know, we're also experiencing a less predictable climate. There's been a drought. There's been issues with water supplies. Our groundwater management plan rollout has shown that we are out of compliance on a couple of items with our groundwater management. We need to work on that and get it back into shape. So I think there's an increasing awareness that the balance is delicate. And I do think, especially because of the fires and how far reaching their impacts were, that we're in a different place than we were 10 years ago with our thinking about our environment and how we might best take care of it. So with leadership in the county, you know, I think also that we have made some changes. The board of supervisors will be once this race is done, there will only be one person who's been there for more than a couple of years. And that's a huge shift. And that's coming from the voters. You know, they're saying we're ready for something new. And I do think it's different. Maybe not, you know, I don't think from leadership that it's a radical departure, but I just think there's a little more awareness about the moment we're in right now.
Mm-hmm. From the perspective of, and it's always walk a mile in the other shoes, right? Mm-hmm. From the perspective of somebody working on a development plan, and I'm thinking about the owners of the property where the La Colleen project was proposed. They had like 9 years of time into that. They checked all the boxes. They went through the county's process, mm-hmm. and then they got to the final moment with the board and got shot down. You know, first of all, I think that's how you get lawsuits, number one, right? And then secondly, how does that affect other people either already here in the community or who want to be in the community and do development projects if they don't feel like they can trust that process?
Right. Well, this is part of the certainty that people are saying they're hoping for. They want to have a sense of, if I move forward on something, I want the outcome I want, right? And I want to have an idea at the outset if it's possible for me. And I think that's very reasonable. I don't think it's a good outcome to have somebody working on a project for years and years to have it turned around on them for one reason or another. You know, they've made a substantial investment and they're hopeful, and you know, that's just not great. You know, I don't think anybody thinks that's the way it should go. But at the same time, there were, you know, things about that project that the supervisors cited that were very specific, that speak to the policies in place and the rules in place, and their interpretation of that was different, which is within their jurisdiction to decide that. So again, I think that we need a more long-term planning. I was talking about a habitat conservation plan for our community, and that's exactly the kind of situation that process would help prevent. Because you would be thinking strategically about where does this development work and where does it not work. So so just front loading that by doing the difficult work of a stakeholder process at the outset instead of having acrimony at you know, years down the road, I think is very much, you know, a trade-off we should make.
Yeah. It does seem like there's a trust relationship and that all the cards are on the table, mm-hmm. you know, from the government side. And you expect the developer to put all their cards on the table and not trick you or, you know, try to end run you. Yeah. So both sides have to agree to that. Yeah. And I think going forward, maybe this is the learning moment.
Right. And know? I would also say that, you know, coming from a background in natural resources, there are things about our permitting process where really understanding the policy and the requirements can help everyone make the right decisions all the way through, because there are occasions where a project will move through apparently on its merits, but then at the very last minute, like the Mountain Peak case is an example, it got kicked back from the court to the supervisor saying, you were wrong, this really does require a full environmental impact report, you have to change your ruling. And that was another 10-year project, right?
Yeah.
And that property is now for sale. They've apparently backed out of their proposal. And so, you know, that wasn't, I don't think, a good outcome for that family either. And if the supervisors had understood the policy better, they never would have allowed that to go through without a full EIR. But I'm not saying, you know, I just don't think they comprehended fully the requirements of the policy, and that's how it got to that point. And so that would be the kind of skills I would bring, is that I do know those rules and I know how the requirements need to be set up to be met. And I think that would help us.
If you had been in the supervisor seat when the La Colleen vote came up, how would you have voted on it?
Oh my goodness. I can't say that. I didn't look at every single document they looked at. I wasn't there for every last part of the testimony. So, you know, I don't know. But I will say that I think the decision they made was well supported by the existing policy. And you know, the other thing about this community is that at some point, you know, there's the science and then there's what you aspire to that's above and beyond that. And this community for decades and decades, I mean, since the 60s, has had a pretty strong leaning toward conservation. I mean, people will, you know, there's so many, I look around the hills and I think of all the projects I know about that I don't see because they never got built because the community said no. And there's, you know, probably about a dozen of them that would have been sizable that just aren't there. And, you know, right or wrong, as a representative, you're there not only to interpret and enforce policy, you're there to work on behalf of your constituents, you know? So there's that aspect too.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the hillside development, which has now become the focus, the valley floor is sort of spoken for, you could say, and things get a lot more complicated when you start getting into the hillsides. Mm-hmm. I guess the primary question to start from, being factually based as you are, how many plantable acres are left? How many more of these fights are there going to be over developing in ag watershed areas on slopes when a lot of it isn't plantable?
Yeah, so great question. And there are depending on what you count, there's probably between 30 and 45,000 acres that are still plantable in the hills.
Wow.
Yeah, we could almost double the amount of ag in this county
if we could.
I mean, that is not taking into account the new road regulations from the Department of... from the state, which do potential. There's an exception in those rules for agriculture, and it remains to be seen how that will be interpreted. So I'll say that. But yeah, we're nowhere near the end of developing the hills under the current regulations in this county. So we're developing on average 200 acres a year right now, and that's why there's so much conflict, because it's noticeable. It's noticeable. And I am concerned about our water supplies. I want to see us do more monitoring and measuring to make sure that we're not negatively impacting drinking water for our residents, which is primarily managed by the cities, in making a trade-off of allowing more development, which creates revenue for the county. So, you know, I think there's a conversation there about where our values are that we should be looking at.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned affordable housing as a priority issue, and the pattern has been when mandates come down from the so-called RENA allocations, mm-hmm. how many housing units you have to zone for and so on, the county has had to rely on partnering with the cities to keep urban development in urban areas and not sprawl out and affect, of course, the Ag Preserve and other things. I'm hearing from people now that we can't maintain that very much longer, that the cities themselves, cities and towns, are getting all their properties are spoken for and full. And there comes a time when the county's going to have some very difficult decisions about having to actually zone for residential development in the county. How do you tackle that?
Sure. I see some opportunities. Probably the biggest thing coming is that on the November ballot this year, there's going to be a, it's BAFA, it's like a Bay Area we're going to have to look that one up on Google, folks. But there's going to be a bond measure on the ballot that will enable us to have a whole lot more money regionally to help support affordable housing construction. And, you know, there's a complicated set of issues as to why this is so hard, because there really have been good people in the community who want to make progress on this. And there's a few different threads about it that make it extra difficult to build affordable housing, but one of them is funding, and that bond measure will really help. So I encourage everyone to vote in November if housing is a priority, affordable housing is a priority for you, which I think it is for most of us. So that's part of it. We've been doing infill in the cities with accessory dwelling unit assistance for homeowners. There's a good program for that, and it also exists at the county level. So if you live in the county area, similarly, homeowners can get assistance funding upgrades or construction of accessory dwelling units to increase density and create more affordable housing. And we also have a workforce proximity housing assistance program in the county, which helps people buy houses closer to where they live so they don't have to commute, which is fantastic. And I would love to see us continue that program, continue to fund it, find ways to do that. There have been redevelopment areas identified in the city of Napa specifically through their general plan process, and finding ways to create enough carrots for the current landowners to do conversions on low density properties that could become mixed use and higher density would actually take us a lot of the way there. And another thing is that when you look at housing density, that has a lot to do with how much land you're actually going to need to create the housing stock that will help us have a better mix relative to the jobs currently available in the community. So, for example, if you build single family detached homes, which is mostly what we have in this community, it will take 200 to 400 acres of space to meet our 4,000 unit housing requirement. That's a lot of space, and that we can't really do in the cities. But if you can do dense three-story construction, you can meet that same requirement in 50 acres or less, possibly. So that becomes very reasonable. We might be able to find 50 acres inside the city. And if you raise the height limit, which may be controversial, and again, a city issue, not a county thing, but if the city's willing to have that conversation, you need even less land. So, it's a trade-off thing, you know. You might have to have a more urban center or urban satellite areas in the city to meet those housing goals, but the trade-off would be that you'd get to keep the open space and that feeling of place that we all treasure here.
Running out of time, but I want to hit a couple other points real quick here. Lake Berryessa has been in a state of flux for a long time. It appeared there was an agreement for redevelopment that fell through. In your opinion, Amber Manfrey, what should happen at Lake Berryessa?
Well, I'm a geographer, and I have spent a lot of my life in the eastern hills of this county. They're rugged, they're difficult, and when I look at that landscape and why it's so difficult for resorts to thrive there, I think the geography is really driving that challenge. So I think we need to be realistic about what the place, what the carrying capacity for that place is in terms of people visiting. And we also need to let the residents out there lead, because there are quite a lot of people living in Berryessa Highlands and Circle Oaks and Gordon Valley, Spanish Flat, you know, and other areas around Berryessa who have, you know, every reason to be able to determine what the outcome is near where they live and in their daily experience. And when I'm talking to residents out there, I'm hearing, number one, they're concerned about fire, you know, so having a lot of people hauling boats up and partying and I mean, I can't tell you how many fires have been started by cars just below Berryessa Dam over the last 10 or 15 years. It's like there's one every single year just about. And I'm sure that makes people nervous. But there's other people who want more services out there. They want a gas station. They want a convenience store or a grocery store, really anything. There's very few businesses at this point. And to sustain that, you do need some more numbers of people than just the people living there, you know? So it's a bigger conversation. It should involve the residents. And I think we need to be realistic about what makes sense given the constraints of the landscape and also the fire risk that we're now seeing.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, while we're talking about those isolated areas of residential up there, some of those places have tremendous problems with water systems, infrastructural needs that when we were living in a city of 75,000, we can all share the cost of a new water treatment plant. It's not that much of an impact, but if you're in a community of 250 people or something, those costs are astronomical these days and they can't be supported. That's a really knotty problem, in my opinion. How would you address that?
This is a difficult one for the county. So what's going on is that some of the water districts in the Berryessa area did not project the cost of eventual upgrades, which everybody knew would eventually, you know, at some point be needed. They didn't assess those through the years. And so now the system needs upgrades, but there hasn't been any money set aside to do them. And the residents out there are not really able to sustain the cost of a big one-time fee. So, you know, that's a bad problem to have. I have some hope in this area because the city manager, Joy Eldridge, for the city of Napa Water District is doing a wonderful job bringing together the managers of different water districts in our community to start talking about solving their problems more collaboratively. This is really the kind of work I want to see us doing. I personally would like to explore the idea of having a countywide water agency. That's something that Sonoma County has. It's something that Yolo County has. And Solano County, actually, I'm not sure about Yolo, but I meant Solano. Solano County has a countywide water agency, and that allows users to share costs and for water management to be more connected and cohesive. So, you know, having seen some other systems where it works really well, I think it could potentially do some good here. We have probably, I don't know, about 20 different water districts. There's five or six out by Berryessa. There's one in Angwin. There's every city has its own. And there's a few other ones in the valley. And it's just a lot of duplicated effort and money spent managing water, which ultimately a lot of is very interconnected. Like our North Bay Aqueduct serves every single city from American Canyon to Calistoga, you know, but yet it's managed by, I don't even know, five, six, seven different water agencies. And the Local Agency Formation Commission has suggested that we look into that. And I think they have a good point.
Last question because of time, and this one is really not relevant to any of these serious issues, but just in sense of curiosity. Mm-hmm. You've been around here a long time. You know how it used to be that if there was one woman on the Board of Supervisors, that was kind of an anomaly, right? Oftentimes, in my experience here for 37 years, it's been five guys, right? Now, we not only have a majority of women on the board, but there's the very good potential that the entire board will be women after this election in March. What does that mean? I guess is the only question I can ask. To you, what does that mean? Does it mean, is it something good for first of all, and does it represent anything other than just a matter of chance?
You know, I think it does represent social progress. There's been underrepresentation of women in governance, you know, throughout the history of the Western world, and you know, like that is significant. You know, that said, it's still going to be five people who have to work together to solve problems, and the idea is that we're all bringing our unique skill sets to the table, plus our attitude about whether or not we want to be effective and get things done, and how we think that we do that. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to complementing the skills of the other board members, because I think we'll just have an incredible opportunity to do good work for this community. And the bottom line is that's the goal.
Amber Manfrey in the Berry Pod. Amber Manfrey is a candidate for supervisor in District 4. And as we've been trying to emphasize, it's coming up much quicker than you might imagine. The election day is March 5th. Voting by mail will start around the 10th of February or even sooner. You'll have ballots in your mailbox and be ready to check them off and send them in. So pay attention, listen, and participate and know who you're voting for. Amber Manfrey, thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you, Barry.
That's the Berry Pod, recorded on January 18th, 2024.
You're listening to the Berry Pod, tastings from Wine Country Live in the morning.
On 99.3, thevine.com.